92.9. Hey, joining us here in the Booster Juice Listener Lounge today, Chaos.
Hey, what's up?
Congratulations on the release of the new record, Black on Blonde.
Thank you very much.
That is daring, man.
It is. It's. I think it's like, I always say, it's like kind of splitting the atom. You know, it's either going to like blow up in your face or actually blow up.
Well, you know, when I read it was going to be one disc of hip hop and one disc of rock, I was kind of like, okay.
Right.
I was just thinking to myself, I'm like, if Eminem said he was coming out with a rock record,
right,
we would all have a good laugh.
For sure. For sure. And that response, and that's a natural response of a Canadian. That's a natural response of a Neil Young lover. But what people don't know is I'm also a Neil Young lover. So therefore, you know, the Neil Young sample on this record that like held the record up, like Neil actually was like, yeah, you could take that. So for me, it's like I've been going around the country on a gospel level. I'm saying to people, I'm saying to young hip hoppers, I'm saying to people from whether you're black or white, you need to accept Neil Young into your life. If you're a Canadian musician, once you do that, your light will shine.
What is it about Neil Young's music that speaks to so many people?
I think it's his attitude. He was like pre-grunge. His fashion was on point. You see pictures of that guy and he was just like everything. You could tell. Musicians hear other stories of him like pulling up to, I think Sam Roberts told me this, of him pulling up to a studio and like kind of seeing cars there and walking in for a second and just leaving and everyone wondering like, where did he go? He just has this kind of vibey thing to him where you know he's not doing anything just for the sake of doing it. Everything that, you know, even his voice kind of sounds like, you know, ghostly and like a wolf or something, you know, there's so much like, and I've heard his music in so many situations, driving across the country on the tour bus, at parties, and it always just fits in with Canadiana. So I feel like it's cool. I mean, I love Maestro. I feel the same way about people accepting him into their lives for as a forefather of that music. But I feel like sometimes it's not an equal thing. I feel like rock and roll people are open to black music a lot, whereas hip hoppers and black people don't really get in touch with their inner white person. You got to do that. For people talk about, you know, music converging and hippiness and like everyone being one, but I feel like embodying another culture's music and having those people in that culture be like, you did a good job at that, is the easiest way to like delete lines of culture than holding a picket fence or giving a speech. Just a rhythm, a rock rhythm presented like the dog is mine in a way that people go, that's chaos. It's almost like you just deleted 400 years of whatever because you just did something that everyone related to in like one guitar strum, you know, thank Jimi Hendrix, etc., and people who influenced me. But I feel like that's what this record's about. I haven't been to these radio stations or been able to like, you know, come out here because my music took a different route. But I feel like there's a message behind this record, which is like, let's just share now. Like there's the internet, there's everyone sharing. They're literally sharing music. Let's really share. Let's take it to the next level and get that response where you're like, okay, you're going to do a rock record, and then have you go, oh, it's pretty cool. You know, that's what I get off on.
Well, you know, it's very interesting you bring that up. I feel like there's a disproportionately small amount of black people making rock records.
Right.
Yet, you know, back in the 60s and stuff, guitar was owned by black men, you know, like the strong blues guitarist, Jimi Hendrix.
Right.
You know, and nowadays, I almost feel like there's a pressure if you're a black person to release a certain kind of music. Do you feel that pressure?
Oh yeah. You're like, that's my testimony. I feel like, but once you forget about that, once you don't care about that, you're actually a free spirit and you can do what you want. However, if I couldn't rap in a certain way or make music on a basis, and let's say urban, just to be more politically correct, because I don't want to, but if I hadn't had a history of making urban music that pleased urban music lovers, then it wouldn't matter whether it made rock. It's more weirder. Like Lenny Kravitz never rapped. So he was just a phenomenon for what he was. Jimi Hendrix didn't rap. I think it's different now because rap didn't exist when the Beatles were around or when Hendrix was around. So now here's this new thing called rap, which is exciting and almost like the music of today. We all know we're the rock station. We don't have to pull out stats. Kids are listening to hip hop. You know what I mean? So I kind of wanted to tote my head to rap by going, okay, cool, I'll make a rap record just to do it, to mark it off. But the real love on this was trying to get into the rock record and just coming up with something new. And I thought, that's why, again, splitting the atom, because it was like, I could have put a rock record out, but then I think it's getting more attention because there's a hip hop record at side. It's a side plate. It's like a good kind of buffet. People are like, oh, I can go check out some hip hop songs. I can go check out some rock songs. This is what music's about. It's about encompassing a lot of things.
You know, I've got so many questions about your new album, and we'll get back to that in just a sec. First, I've got kind of an oddball question for you. You mentioned earlier that Neil Young's a real vibey kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about this on the weekend. We were out doing karaoke, and you know, they have like these bad cover versions of all of the songs. And you know, you can hear somebody sing a good version next to one of those songs, and I hear it and I go, that's not a hit.
Right.
You know, the original's a hit, that's not a hit. How much of music is just magic and vibe, and how much of it is skill and technical proficiency?
That's a sick question. I'm glad I took the flight just to answer that question out here. I think music is magic. It's the last form of magic we have, and I feel like a big complaint of a lot of my musician friends is, you know, Pro Tools. And, you know, I'm sure you guys hear songs all the time and everything sounds the same on the radio. There's no dynamics, you know, and I feel like that magic really comes from performing off the floor. The thing with The Dog Is Mine is that that's me, Ryan Dahl, who is in Age of Electric. He's on guitar and also playing bass on that. My drummer from like all back Crucial days, Ray Garraway, who used to be in a band called Salvador Dream. If people know, I can name drop. He was the drummer of that band. And I was like, we had one day left in the studio and I was like, let's just do weird this thing to call. Let's record off the floor. And that's why the song has that bombastic like attitude to it, because it's dudes playing rock and roll. It's not put together in a computer. And I'm not dissing any of the other bands out there, but you'd hard pressed to find dudes who can put a song together like that and just put it out. I'm not saying we didn't like edit and do stuff. I'm not going to try to be like, you know, a purist, like, you know, whatever. But I do believe the core of the song is people playing together. And I think that's the magic that's missing from music now. Take that 10,000 Leagues Under the Sea and realize that a lot of the dance music is just computers upon a computer, upon an autotune, upon a vocal that was taken, that was smashed, that was cut and chopped and screwed and did. Then the magic is gone, because it's not really people just in a studio vibing. I mean, you know, as weird as it sounds, when I Wikipedia'd that Taylor Swift song, the Getting Back Together song, what I liked about what I saw in the song is that they were like, what's going on in your life? And she's like, oh, well, this is a guy, and did it. And she started strumming it on guitar, and all of a sudden everyone in the room was like, a song was made. I think that's why that song also had impact. It doesn't matter if it's rock or pop. You feel it on the other end of the radio when the person had a real experience and was able to translate that with a group of people in the studio. And that's, you could be the most technical person in the world, but it doesn't mean you're going to be able to write a great song. It's like, sometimes that actually hinders you. No, like
I'm that guy.
No, well, I've had people like, you know, it's like I think I was on George Stromatopoulos the other day, and he was like, pull out a guitar, and he's like, play. And he wanted me to play some song, and he showed me chords. I'm like, I don't know what those chords are. I don't know music. And I've been told by other musicians when I've been studying music, one of my good friends was like, he took the book from me. He's like, don't. He's like, you're going to ruin your thing. I don't want. And he was really serious. At first, I was offended. I was like, you just told me to learn because I'll be good. But in reality, he was a true friend. He's like, don't poison your mind with the technicality. So I feel rock and roll is that a little bit of know-how, a little bit of like understanding, but a lot of like swag and attitude.
Now, your new record, Black on Blonde, was recorded at kind of an interesting venue, too, from what I understand.
Yeah, a good friend, Hayden Christensen, who's one of my best friends, who played Darth Vader. I'm a Star Wars freak. This is how we met. I saw him on a plane, and I kind of mobbed him. And he ended up knowing who I was, weirdly enough. And
your record was recorded at Darth Vader's house.
Basically, right? And he bought that house when at 22 years old, when he just got the role from Star Wars. He's like, I'm balling. I'm going to get this house. And then after he got over that whole Hollywood thing, which he's a very intense, beautiful soul, it didn't take long before he was over it. And then he just had this house. I was in LA, went to the house, and I was like, this place would be amazing for recording. He's like, really? Like, it's almost like he Jedi mind tricked me into the like whole thing. And then he told me about Laurel Canyon and like Joni Mitchell and Graham Nash and like the Jim Morrison's house. You could go see it if you supposedly, you know, it's there. So it, and you know, again, I keep name dropping him, but another good friend of mine is Sam Roberts. He recorded his very first record with like Eileen and like No Sleep. That was in Laurel Canyon. And I told him I was there. We had a conversation. He's like, dude, you're going to do like the weirdest harmonies and all this stuff is going to happen. There's like ghosts there. You know, the Red Hot Chili Peppers recorded in Houdini's house with Rick Rubin. Blood Sugar Sex Magic was recorded there, like down the street from where I was. It's got a really cool history of just weird weird people just going there. And it's the hills of LA. It's where the cool people escape from all the BS and like the kind of more intense soul people hang out there. So that vibe is there. That's like, okay, Hollywood's 5 minutes away, but we up here are kind of seeking something different. And that translates in the whole venue. So yeah, it was a cool thing for me, especially being such a Canadian Toronto dude, city hip hop, to kind of like feel that. And I think that the Dog Is Mine is like Sunday morning's one thing, but LA's effect on Sunday morning is Dog Is Mine. It's like Born to Run is one thing, but LA's effect on Born to Run is just a little bit more guns and a little bit more Sunset Boulevard, a little bit more desperate and a lot of swag, you know? So I have to thank him for that because he put me in that position to do that and just said, yo, go ahead, do it, and just let me do it.
Well, you mentioned Sam Roberts, too. There's a ton of really cool collaborations on this record. Emily Haynes from Metric, Sebastian Granger of DFA, Corey Hart. Is that the sunglasses at night,
yeah,
Corey
yeah,
Hart?
Yeah, that's him.
He's on your record.
He's on my record. That's just a whole other story of, like, the Junos and like wanting to do something cool for the Junos in 2008. Sunday Morning was out and I somehow got his email from an industry heavyweight and I emailed him like a kid, like, dude, you know, sunglasses is the same key as like Sunday. Could you imagine if you came out and just like, don't mess around with the guy at the end of Sunday Morning? And he hit me back like not even a couple of hours. He's like, oh, I'm a fan and thanks for reaching out. My daughters, who are heavy tennis players, had a tournament. He couldn't do it. I was kind of bummed, but he actually would like still contact me. How was the Junos? And that was the beginning of it. Just like talks about the industry. Like I'd be down on something. He's like, oh, don't get down, man. This is just this. And he's like, you know, he's a painter. He'd send me his paintings. Like he's evolved way beyond sunglasses. Like talking to that guy, he's like, it's like that whole thing of when the people's ready, the teacher appears. I didn't think it would be Corey Hart, but honestly, that's why it's like always that weird Pulp Fiction Chinese movie, like Asian movie, where it's like the dude that you least suspect ends up telling you, no, wax on, wax off. Wear your sunglasses in the day and night. You know what I mean? So I feel like, you know, as a kid, he was like, I didn't register it. He just his, you know, he was really the first guy that swiped girls from me because everybody's girl had his picture in their locker. You're kind of mad about it. But you kind of were like, wow, this dude's like infiltrating my grade 7 hallway. So when he talked, I was like, yeah, you're that dude. I can't really say anything. Like, yeah, you know, so it's all that just nostalgia and just feeling like a kid. Sometimes you got to, you know, talk to these people and be a fan of someone just to get back that feeling of being a fan of someone. You know, no matter how many records you sold or how many times you've toured the country, in my case, if you're not a fan of somebody, then you're just going to get jaded and you're not going to be able to like really enjoy music. And that's why the song kind of just, if someone heard it that was 16 years old, I don't think they'd go, that's Corey Hart. It's just a cool hip hop song with a dude singing. You know, it's electro music. He did electro music. Now it's all electro music. It just sort of fits. So all these collaborations are like that. They're friends and people emails and like brooding and like, okay, now it turns into the song. Nobody's like, can you cough on my track so I can put my name on your record? That's not really what I do, you know?
Well, it's interesting. These are all, you know, busy, busy people. Like, that's an all-star list of collaborations
right.
for one album or a double album. But were these sort of, you know, cyber Pro Tools session?
A lot of them were. And the thing is that that's how it is today. I know bands like Postal Service and Gnarls Barkley, it's a common thing right now. And, you know, for someone like Black Thought, who drives on a bus, he does a Jimmy Fallon show. He hates planes, so he'll take a bus from Philadelphia to New York every day to do Jimmy Fallon, you know, and does his thing, and that's his continuation. It's very difficult to be like, yo, let's go in the studio, unless I'm in the same place as him. So I just took advantage of that, and also the fact that there was so much time. Like between records, it took me 2 years to make this. So some of these songs took like, you know, the Corey Hart took like 4 or 5 months, you know, because it was just like, no, this isn't right. And he was like, I don't want to do some dumb collaboration. What are you doing here with this arrangement? I don't really like this. Like more real conversations happen because as the things start to stockpile and become this magical thing, everybody wanted their kind of, you know, their contribution to be so great. You know, like someone like Sam Roberts, it's like, okay, I got this song. 2 months later, oh, I finally downloaded it. It's cool. Another 2 weeks later, okay, I'll do something on it. Another 2 months later, you know, between putting his kids to bed, it's like, oh, I did a vocal tonight. Oh, let me see what you... So things take time. And sometimes artists, it behooves them to take time between projects because that's when you come up with the really cool stuff too. You don't want to rush stuff and always try to be king for a day. Put out a new record, like press. And that just, you know, your music isn't as good. You can't rush the cake, you know what I mean? Just to be on TV and just to have that position. Better, I wouldn't care if people forgot about me. I had no money. At least what I put out, is going to be true to what my life experiences was between that time, as opposed to just keep putting out records to stay hot, but then the music isn't good. I feel that's happening in music too much, where people just want to keep putting records out when, you know, sometimes it's, you just don't need to make a record. You need to go to the cottage and like hang out with some girls and be like, after you're hanging out with the girls, be like, now I'll make a record. You know what I mean? That influences, you have to live that. And I feel like that's also a true testament to the way this thing went down.
Now, the first single from Black on Blonde is The Dog Is Mine. It's a breakup song. It's so good, I want to split up with my wife. And I love
it. Yeah.
So, what is the worst thing you ever lost in a breakup?
My soul. For a small amount of time. I mean, The Dog Is Mine, I mean, I had dogs all growing up. But this was really, three of my friends and myself all broke up with girls at around the similar time, and mine was the shortest breakup, so I was the least underwater, so I had perspective, and I'd be like, no, it's cool, and we're gonna let's go out, and like I was trying to be the cheerleader. And then about out of those relationships, two of them were like, now about the dog, and I was like, and I would just be talking to my dudes at the bar, and they're like, but I'm taking the dog. I'm like, dude, this is not about your dog right now. But it is, but it's my dog, but she thinks it's her dog. We're gonna do custody things. I'm like, dude, it's not about the dog. And I just thought, when I was writing that guitar riff in the studio, it was almost like The Dog Is Mine becomes like something way more like, almost like, you know, who dogged who, like who's gonna win. It's almost like I won in this. People want to win after relationships. People want to be able to tell their friends, well, yeah, it's I'm kind of winning, when it's like nobody wins. If you love someone, then you're both losing, you know, probably for a long time. So it's like, I just put that out there as a tongue in cheek, because I thought it was a positive breakup song, because I feel like sometimes there's triumph and kind of poking fun and having a good time with something bad that happens in your life, instead of like, you know, I love Bright Eyes and I love Cat Power. She's actually a friend of mine, but that's one way to deal with sadness. But there's other ways where you can actually like mix a little ditty about it and have fun with it.
Now, if you told me a year ago that I'd be saying Chaos, that guy's got the guitar riff of 2013.
Right.
I would be kind of shocked. But you kind of do.
Thank you.
That is pretty cool, man. The first time I heard that, you know, it's a song where it wasn't even the chorus that stood out to me. It was just that catchy little guitar riff that sort of stuck in my brain. Very cool.
Thank you. Very cool song.
Tickets went on sale this morning, of course, for your show at Avenue Theater, which is coming up this spring. What other touring plans do you have in the works?
Yeah, that's going to be a part of a tour that starts off, I think, in Toronto or Montreal, the Danforth Music Hall, and we go across. So by the time we get here, we'll be finishing off probably in like Calgary and then Vancouver. So by the time I get to the good people of Edmonton, the show will be primed and dope, and like we would have played the most of the tour. And that's why Calgary and Edmonton, you know, have always been really cool for me, because by the time we get out here, we've played everywhere else and we're like kind of getting our juices up. And it's really fun to, I associate coming to these Calgary and Edmonton with like being at that point in the game where you like your set list is perfect, you've played it a couple of times. So I'm excited about that. But that's going to be a Canadian tour. We're going to chill a bit, go to America, go to Europe a bit. The record's coming a bit later there, and then maybe come back in the fall or summer or something.
You know what? Last time you were in this room was, I think it was 2006,
yeah.
December 2006.
Yeah.
It's about 6 years ago. If you're coming through again,
let's do it.
You want to bring your band through here, man. We'd love to have you back.
I had a good time. I love, like, when people, it's a small room, it's the truest form of communication. So if you guys will have me, I'll be here for sure.
Catch this interview and other off-air highlights in this week's Lane Mitchell Show podcast, free on iTunes and at sonic1029.com.